Now he sees in the 13th verse, but he doesn't say, I then saw. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the ancient days, they brought him before him. In other words, this now is a scene, an appendix, as it were. The continuity is ended. Your then, after, until, those time elements, those words which carry a time aspect, have stopped. Now he saw, and he sees one brought to the Ancient of Days, and he comes there to get a to be received dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom which shall not be destroyed. All right, in other words, apart from the continuity, you have introduced the stone that was cut out of a mountain without hands. You see, that was a separate from the continuity of the image. Now, here is something separate from the continuity. But you see, in Daniel 7, one thing has been added to the continuity. You have, over here, you have your Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and the ten down to those. All right, you have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, and the little horn, the amplification of it. In other words, the two together in one, the two legs. You see, you have a comparison. But added into this is a judgment. And you have Christ brought into that picture as a Son of Man. He had to be taken from among men. He was the Son of Man. Now let's go a little bit further. The explanation starts. And in the explanation, the thing that I want to note with you, I will start with the 20th verse. And of the ten horns which were in his hand, and of the other which came up, before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Who made the war? Let me ask you a question. Did this beast, before the horn came up, make war with the saints? All right, let's read what it says that this beast is going to do. Let's go back to the 7th chapter again. The seventh verse. Terrible, dreadful, exceedingly, it had great teeth, it devoured and break in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, it was diverse, and so forth. But it says it's a little horn that's going to make war with the saints and going to prevail. You know, I have thought for a long time that pagan Rome was just as a persecuting power against the Christians as papal Rome, until we had begun reading for worship a book, The Two Republics, by A.T. Jones. And in that book, The Two Republics, he shows that while there were some specific persecutions by certain Roman emperors, there was no general complete persecution, and that while many of the Roman emperors were terrible, exceedingly terrible, and that they killed and killed and killed and killed, the populace, irrespective of religious conviction, fell. And so therefore it was not something specifically directed against the Christians, only in a few instances. In other words, Jones was studying history in the time of righteousness by faith to try to get everything in the picture of truth, and to get all the myths out of our thinking. And I think that that's a pretty good concept. After all, the righteousness of faith and testimonies to ministers, page 65, is what? Pure, unadulterated truth. And I think that everything that as far as God's people are concerned ought to be pure, unadulterated truth. And so Jones was trying to straighten up the myths of history. He just comes right out and says that this idea is a myth. But when you come to papal Rome, what does it say? They sought to wear out the saints of the Most High. They made war with the saints of the Most High, and they prevailed against them. Rome was determined that there was to be nothing of the vestiges of true Christianity left. It was going to be papal and papal concept. And where do they come from?
Right out of the beast.
The dogmas of pagan Rome baptized with the garb of Christianity. Now, let's continue on. They're going to prevail until the Ancient of Days came. And what was the rendering, the decision? And the judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. That is a legal term. The court sits, and the decision or the judgment of the court is rendered in favor of whom? The saints of the Most High. And then he says, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Ah, when is the kingdom possessed? When the stone is cut out of the mountain without hands? Oh, by the way, we probably ought to get a verse in the New Testament to establish that. I think that's in Matthew, the 25th chapter. I'm going to have to pull again. That's probably it. Matthew 25. Okay, 31. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory. And before Him shall be gathered all nations. And to those on the right hand He says, come ye blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. When do the saints possess the kingdom? When Christ comes in His glory. Therefore, before Christ comes in His glory, what is the thing going to take place? A judgment is going to be rendered on behalf of the saints of the Most High. There is a prophetic, definitely establishing a pre-Advent judgment. The judgment is rendered for the saints prior to the coming of Christ the second time, after the Ancient of Days sits, and He sits before the words of the great horn. He sits after the time of the assigned to it, and therefore what do? You have 1844 pinpointed generally in Daniel the 7th chapter. And then where do you go to get the specifics? 8th chapter. 9th chapter. My brother and my sister are pioneers. When they laid this faith, they laid a systematic prophetic understanding of truth. Systematic and solid. Internally, the principles of interpretation are right there. Oh, how the devil has thought to tear them up, even by those who profess to be giving a message. Tragic. And how many people are just running out there? My friend, I would rather be on a horse and buggy going into heaven than on a jet crashing into hell. And I think we better know exactly what the foundations are. All right, now, let's continue. He goes on to explain now in detail. The fourth beast, the fourth kingdom. The 10 horns are 10 kings that shall rise, and another shall rise after them. And there's a very interesting whole history that verifies in absolute detail these verses here. And may I suggest, if you have the book, keep it, don't even loan it out, mark it, study it, and if you don't have the book, get it. Facts of Faith by C.E. Edwardson. And it'll give you a historical detail on these particular verses that is absolutely astounding. I'll let you see it in the library, but I don't know how much I'll let you touch it. All right, what I'm trying to tell you is, it's a very valuable book. Facts of Faith by, I think it's Christian Edwardson. Now if you'll come down, the 25th verse is familiar to us about the speaking the great words against the Most High. That is God wearing out the saints of the Most High, thinking to change times and laws. They shall be given into His hand in the time and times and the dividing of times. But the judgment shall sit. And what's the objective of it? And they shall take away His dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. In other words, the purpose of the judgment is to take away the dominion of this beast power and this little horn power. It's all together. But what's behind this? What's behind all these powers? The devil. And he comes into play as we go through these prophecies. This is what's going to be exterminated. This is going to be the thing that's going to be taken down and out of the picture. The devil. And he starts to take it away. And the way that that dominion is taken away is in the proclamation of truth. God used the Advent movement on earth to start breaking up the dominion of the beast. And look what we've done. Betrayed his sacred trust. Are we talking about the papacy anymore? Well, you get the latest book. Is it God's Love, Volume 1? God's Love, Volume 2? God Cares, that's it. God Cares, Number 1. God Cares, Number 2. You read that book, especially on Daniel 7, and it tells you about Christian Rome. No longer is it papal Rome, it's Christian Rome. Tell me when Rome was ever Christian. The prophecy says that this little horn was never Christian. It came out of what? This beast. Do we understand the symbol? Christian Rome. Tragic. Okay. And then it goes on to say that the kingdom, the dominion, the greatness of the kingdom and the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. All right, let's just summarize briefly. Here in the ABC prophecy of Daniel 2, you had a sequence. Daniel 7, the sequence is repeated. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. A little horn. The sequence is repeated. There are certain details still to be pinpointed and finalized. And so it closes at this particular point. Now we need to only turn to the next prophecy. And so that you can see the blackboard as we go into it, I'll just set my animals down here. These animals don't bother me. They're pretty well tamed over the years. Now, the thing about this prophecy to get its interpretation is the setting. And I want you to compare settings. How much did Daniel tell you in Daniel 7 about where he was? He what? In the 7th chapter? All right, he in the first year of the king, Belshazzar, king of Babylon. He had visions. He was in his bed. He was sleeping. He saw the visions by night and so forth. Are you even sure he was in Babylon? He's just noted as far as the year. There's no specific detail given as to where he was. But now when you come to the 8th chapter, it goes into detail. Notice. In the third year of the reign of the king Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw it, I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. Now this is how many years difference? First to the third, possibly 2 years. Now it's very possible that he was at Shushan in the palace, that he was retired, because you see, who all had reigned between Nebuchadnezzar? Well, you had Nebuchadnezzar, then you had Evil-Merodach, his son, and then he was followed by a son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, who in turn was followed by a son, and then there was another son-in-law, Nabonidus, and now Belshazzar. You see, you've got a whole series of individuals in there, and now here's Daniel in the third year of Belshazzar. It's very possible that he was retired in the retirement center was at Shushan. Now, when it comes down further at the time of, at the end of Belshazzar's dominion, he's back in Babylon, and we can understand why he got back into Babylon, and it's a very interesting, in fact, I think we'll note that prophecy, because it tells us something too. Anyway, he goes into detail now. He says, I was in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Because here's a chapter now that deals with north, east, south, and west. And this is what we need to carefully understand when we start studying this particular map. And I'm going to put it up here right now while I'm thinking about it. North, west, south, and east. And I put on here Shushan. He says, this is where I was, in Shushan, in the province of Elam, by the banks of the Ulai. I may not have this exactly in the spot as you get a better map, but it's pretty close. In fact, I think that we can pass these out and you can have a copy too. We'll put it on pause so these get distributed. But let's start now and take a look at the third verse. And I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. The two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. All right, he was standing here, and here before the river was a ram standing. Now, we're told what this ram is, and we have no question about it. There's no need of any discussion as to what the ram is. We're told specifically, and now we can get a point of direction. Notice there in the 20th verse, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. In other words, he's saying now we're not starting with, the vision says we're not starting with Babylon. Babylon's about ready to pass out, and so he starts with Media Persia. And this ram is standing there. And notice now what it says about this ram. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became what? Great. Now, all right, we're going to follow two words here. Great and directions. This ram was standing here where he saw it, and it pushed what? What's the first?
Westward.
Now, let me ask you just a simple question. Does history say that this was the direction of Persian conquest? Yes. They moved over here and challenged Greece. They moved down in here and conquered Egypt. They moved up in this area and conquered this. The Persian, there was nothing that could stand before it. And that ram is said to be, and it originated right out of here. And what's this power here above Babylon? Media Persia. And it became what? Great. All right, let's proceed now again. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west. Now, who's that he-goat? 21st verse, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Where'd he come from? And he moved from the west. He came in here. Swung down here, in here, and he went on over into India and came back, died at the age of 33, Alexander the Great. He heading that. Now, and then what does it say he became? Therefore, 8th verse, the he-goat waxed what? Very great. Okay, we'll put it here, very. Great, very great. Notice the ascendancy of controlling power, and we got direction. Now, pray tell, why? Why now are we given specific directions? This is internal evidence of specific directions and then specific names as to the ones that are coming from that direction. Because God is nailing down so that there can be absolutely no variation as to what the next power, who the next power is. All right, let's notice. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones to the four winds of heaven. To the four winds of heaven. All right? When you come right down into here, he's finally set his palace and tower in Babylon. That's about here where he finally set it up. And then to the four winds of heaven. And they divided the Alexandrian Empire into four sections. And this became what was known the Syrian part, the king of the north. That's the Seleucid dynasty. Egypt, the Ptolemaic dynasty, the king of the south. And then these other two finally were absorbed. So it ended up, started at maybe even five, got down to four, broke down to three, and finally there was down to two. And that brings you over to the 11th chapter of Daniel. All right, let's go a little bit further. And it says here that this little horn, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great. Great, very great, exceeding great, toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. All right, now think. If this new power was going to move south, and it was going to move east, and it was going to go to the pleasant, toward the pleasant land, what direction would it come from? All right, now think. South, east, and the pleasant land is Palestine. All right, take your circle, and which direction is your line going to come from? Rome. Straight line. Now it's interesting, in history, when Rome began its conquest, it conquered in the exact order in which these directions are given. First, it went south and took care of Carthage. And because the Carthaginians had made a deal with the king over here to harass the Romans and try to work it out to destroy this, they next moved east. And then in the process, they got involved in this eastern Syrian thing, and if I'm not mistaken, and I think my recall is correct, Antiochus Epiphanes was a circle was drawn around him by a Roman general. He said, now you make a decision before you step out of that circle. Who was more powerful then, Rome or Antiochus Epiphanes? And yet they'll say that this little horn has been represented in the thing, in the picture of prophecy as Antiochus Epiphanes. No way. No way. The Historian's History of the World, I think I have my reference correct, indicates that out of this Greek colonization period, and part of the history of Greece was a colonization period, colonies were set up over in Italy here that became so strong in connection with Rome that they were able to aim a death blow at the Macedonian Empire. And thus they came into the picture. And so thus you have that little horn represented there by the horn that came out of one of them. It came out of this section right in here, this part of that four divisions. It came out of here and was established here. But now I want you to go one step further here. Notice the 25th verse when the explanation is given to Daniel of this vision. And he shall stand up against the princes of princes, the Tsar of Tsars, but he shall be broken without hand. Where does that expression come in before? Back here to Daniel 2, that stone that cut out of the mountain without hand. There you see that concept is carrying on through. What does this mean then? That this power, the little horn, will continue to win. To the end. Thus you have Daniel 2 going to the end. You have Daniel 7. It stops. Except that it continues on the kingdom coming in. I mean, it doesn't go into details where the kingdom is going to come in, but never enlarge except the judge. Now in Daniel 8, we're going to Daniel 8, it speaks of that horn going until it is broken off without hand. Now, in the midst of this series of prophecy, the ram, the he-goat, and the little horn, what is introduced? The 2300 days. Okay, now let's get again a parallel. In the midst of the prophecy of the lion, the bear, the leopard, and this nondescript beast, what is brought in? the judgment. In the midst of this prophecy, in the sequence, what is brought in? The time of the judgment. Thus, when you lay these prophecies out in sequence, and this is the historical basis that the Advent movement has it, what do we have? A confirmation of our faith. And again, I cannot resist the temptation. Why then do we have all of this speculation under the concept that it's an Elijah message? Pray tell. What are we going? What's happened to us? Interesting. Now I come to another point in this. Who was commissioned to make Daniel understand this vision? And whose gave it? One of the covering cherubs. But not only that, he says, I, with Michael, hold in these things. God considered this particular aspect of the prophecy and its development so important that Gabriel is named as the one commanded by heaven to make Daniel understand. And when you have Gabriel enter in the picture, you have the highest angel in heaven. Not only that, you have another interesting parallel that you need to keep in mind. The same one that announced the time involved, that's in Daniel 8 and 9, is the same one who became involved in the announcement of the birth of those that were to fulfill that time. How much more important do we have to have a prophecy and the connections for its fulfillment? Interesting, isn't it? All right, now I said that we were going to note one other thing, and I think we can get it in, and then take a break, and then come back, and we'll spend the rest of the time noting some factors in the book of Revelation. That's the second section. Okay, I'm glad you answered what you did, because I was just doing some thinking. All right, let's go one step further in the thing. It says they were sealed, the book was to be sealed at the time of the end. Is that what it says? Was it sealed at the time of the end? What? In other words, it was sealed. There was nothing opened up before the time of the end. Turn with me to Matthew, the 24th chapter. Notice the 15th verse. Matthew, the 24th chapter, 15th verse. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Was that the time of the end? Not when Jesus was talking there to the disciples, was it? Jesus opened the book. Then what does it mean to seal? To close it and to seal it. Does that mean to close it and then tie it up, or does it mean to set it aside? When you're sealed, are you set aside or are you closed? Well, you're closed in one sense, but you're set aside. A seal makes it authenticated. After all, it says in Daniel 9, seal up the vision of the prophecy. What does it mean to seal it up? Make it sure, make it certain. All right, now, how much of this book is centered for us living in the time of the end? Not that it's going to be fulfilled all then, but the lessons are to apply, and the continuation of the prophecy leads us up to how much of the book? All of it. Now, let me go into a detail, and I put a question to you. Where in the entire Bible, where can you find how it describes an individual in vision? Dead. No breath in the body. That's the only place. That's for the skeptics of the last days. All right, let's go one step further. Where do you find in the Bible anything relative to the matter of a vegetarian diet? Okay. In other words, there's aspects in the book of Daniel that you don't find elsewhere. Now then, if you have that in the book of Daniel, then are there lessons for us in the other parts of the book? All right, let's notice the connection between the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation on some things. Is there an image in the book of Revelation? Is there an image in the book of Daniel? Then the book of Daniel is telling us how we ought to act in the time of the image, isn't it? All right, is there a concept in the book of Revelation that we're not supposed to worship, or that we're going to be commanded to worship a power, a beast, and so forth? Is there an example in the book of Daniel of how we're to relate? Then the whole book of Daniel has a lesson for us at this hour. And this is why the devil would like to tear the book up and say the prophecies need to be reinterpreted for this hour instead of the prophecies being interpreted they should be, to give us faith and confidence and let the lessons of the book apply to this hour as to how we're to relate to fulfill prophecy. Now there's one prophecy that I think we fail to understand, and that's the prophecy in Daniel, the fifth chapter. I'm sorry, the lesson of the story in the fifth chapter of Daniel. Why did he have to leave Elam? Or why did he leave Elam? All right, the Persians. The Persians, the Medes and Persians were pushing down. They were starting their conquering. And now they had conquered and were coming right up here this last night of Belshazzar, the very gates of Babylon. Why didn't Daniel say, well, to the Persians, give me political asylum? Would they have done it? Sure they would have. Why? Because he was known. After all, Nebuchadnezzar's sister was married to a Median king. Where do you think Daniel went that time? Where do you think Nebuchadnezzar sent Daniel that time when the three worthies finally had to stand alone? See, when he put that image up there, Daniel wasn't around. Did he know Daniel? Did Nebuchadnezzar know him? Sure he knew him. He got Daniel all the way. Likely he went on a mission for the king to the court of the Medes. He wasn't there. Let me tell you something. He already had the visions of Daniel 8 and 9, didn't he? What was the year? Third year of Belshazzar, wasn't it? And now this is this last year of Belshazzar. And this is well in beyond, I think it's, let me see. A good day, it was a period of time afterwards. Between the 8th and 9th chapters are 11 years. So there was a period of time in there. And he already knew what the next power was, wouldn't he? Wasn't he told that the ram was what? Media Persia? Well, here the Medes and Persians were coming. Didn't he know from Isaiah that the king that was going to release his people to go back to Jerusalem was named Cyrus? Who was leading the Persian horde? Well, why would he run? Why would he run? Why wouldn't he take political asylum and help encourage to get his people out of Babylon back into Judea? Okay. Even though he knew, he had no indication that Babylon's hour was up. And God had put him in Babylon as the prime minister and all of that thing, and so he could not move until God said so. All right, now let's take a look further. When did he move? Let's go to the fifth chapter. What happened that night? What? Feast? And a hand went forth. What did that hand write? Weighed in the balances and found wanting. And nobody could interpret it. And so, finally the queen mother came and said, there's a man that's around here yet that has the spirit of the heavenly gods, and he made known interpretation to your father Nebuchadnezzar, and now have him brought and he'll tell you. And so he was brought, and Belshazzar said to him, okay, you read this and tell me, and I'll make you what? Third ruler of the kingdom, right? See, there was his father Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, third ruler would be Daniel. What did Daniel say? He looked. I don't need it. You take it. All right. Belshazzar went ahead and made the command. So now read the last two verses. And that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Forget about the chapter break. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was the first, that the princes might give an account unto them, and that the king should have no damage. When God spoke, he didn't spend years getting out of loyalty to Babylon. How long did it take him to make a change? As soon as he knew that Babylon was weighed in the balances and found wanting, the next day, when Belshazzar was dead, where was Daniel found? Following the light that God had shown upon his pathway, and he became first president of the kingdom of Media and Persia. How long, and here's the lesson, how long does it take us? And we know, based on prophecy, are we going to be as Daniel? Or are we going to be still caught in the slaughter of the Babylonians by Cyrus, who stood for Christ? And if you have any picture at all of truth, all you need to do is pick up volume 5 and the study on the seal of God, and when it says there that the judgments of God fall upon the spiritual guardians of the people, it also says at the bottom of that paragraph, because they betrayed their trust, it says at the bottom of that paragraph that men, maidens, and little children all... I feel that I ought to probably give a brief summary of the book of Daniel before going to the book of Revelation and calling your attention to one more thing. As you know, there's been controversy in certain areas of prophetic interpretation, even among the pioneers in regard to the king of the north, or that king, really, that does according to his will. Some call it the king of the north, and others call it that king that operates, that the king of the north and the king of the south push at. But James White, in a article in the Review and Herald on November 29, 1877, said this: let us take a brief view of the line of prophecy, 4 times spanned in the book of Daniel. It will be admitted that the same ground is passed over in chapters 2, 7, 8, and 11, with this exception, that Babylon is left out of chapters 8 and 11. We first pass down the great image of chapter 2, where Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome are represented by the gold, the silver, the brass, and the iron. All agree that these feet are not Turkish, but Roman. As we pass down the lion, the bear, the leopard, the beast, the 10 horns, representing the same as the great image, again all will agree that it's not Turkey that is cast into the burning flame, but the Roman beast. So of chapter 8, all agree that the little horn that stood up against the prince of princes is not Turkey, but Rome. In all these 3 lines thus far, Rome is the last form of government mentioned. Now comes the point in the argument upon which very much depends. Does the 11th chapter of the prophecy of Daniel cover the ground measured by chapters 2, 7, and 8? If so, then the last power mentioned in that chapter is Rome. And so that's James White. If you will turn to Daniel 11, the last part, and let's just notice an item or two as we go, and let's forget that the chapter is divided there between 11 and 12. And I'm just going to read it to you and note. In the 36th verse, and the king shall do according to his will. The king, and that's a definite article there. Hamelech. And it's this king that is described there that can be fulfilled in the papacy. Now notice the 45th verse. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now, what is that glorious holy mountain? If you'll notice in Daniel, the ninth chapter, and the 16th verse, O Lord, this is the prayer of Daniel. O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city, Jerusalem, thy holy mountain. Thus it says there that he, that king, shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, that he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Again you have, cut out without hand, that idea that none shall help him. In other words, the same thing starting in the second chapter, carrying right on through, showing divine intervention. Between the seas, you have the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea on one side, you have the Great Sea of the Mediterranean Sea on the other. The Holy Mountain is between Jerusalem. And yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. But when he does this, notice what it says in the next verse, which happens to be the next chapter. And at that time shall Michael stand up, that great prince, or the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as there never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. The standing up of Michael indicates the final warfare with the enemy who has gathered together the nations of earth to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. And they gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Haramageddon, Haramoed, Mount of the Congregation, Jerusalem. And thus the two fit together. And that's the last signal when this happens in relationship to Jerusalem. And thus one can look for Rome, the papacy, to plant the tents, the tabernacles of his palace. Not moving the eternal city, but just a temporary transition. But it's a signal that we've reached the very end. And if, pardon? Peace and unity. But if we are not understanding what's taking place in the relationship to what Jerusalem is standing for today and the thing that Jesus gave, we're not going to have our eyes on this. We're not going to understand it. And yet I understand that when they were under the mantle of the Virgin Mary, they had all kinds of fun with Luke 21:24. I'm told, and that there was a panel discussion that had a great deal of fun to make over that. And so I wrote the individual. I said, that wasn't my date. That wasn't my prophecy. That was Jesus' prophecy. And I merely recognized when it was fulfilled. And so when you start making fun of it, you're making fun of Jesus, not me. So I think we need to understand that. Now let's go to the book of Revelation. But before we go to the book of Revelation, turn to Acts 1, because this will lead us into it. Beginning with the fourth verse of the first chapter. And being assembled together, well, notice the third verse. Let's back up. Right side of the first verse. The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus, to of all that Jesus began both to do and teach, until the day in which he was taken up. After that, he, through the Holy Spirit, had given commandments unto the apostles whom he had chosen, to whom also he showed himself alive after his passion by many infallible proofs, being seen of them 40 days, and speaking of the things pertaining to what? And being assembled together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem, but wait for the promise of the Father, which saith he, ye have heard of me. For John truly baptized with water, but ye shall be baptized in the Holy Spirit not many days hence. When they therefore were come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? And he saith unto them, it is not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father hath put in his own power. Now, what up until this point had all the times and seasons been governed by? They had been governed by 7 years. They had been governed by then the land rested. They had been governed by jubilees. And then you had the proclamation of liberty. That was the Jewish times and seasons. Wilt thou at this time return the kingdom? What did Jesus say? No. The Father has put all things into His hands, right? Now, if the Father took the whole thing into His hands, then how can you and I know what is to be fulfilled beyond this point? The revelation of Jesus Christ, where did He receive it? Which God gave unto Him. God took all the times and seasons into His own hands, and now in the book of Revelation, He gives to Jesus Christ to show unto His servants things which must shortly come to pass, and He sent and signified it by His angel unto His servant John. The book of Revelation stands as God's revelation of how the times and seasons are to be unfolded and what must take place. In the book of Revelation, and we'll note, there is constant reference back and referral back to the types of the Hebrew system. The seven golden candlesticks, the altar of burnt offering, the altar of burnt incense, the Ark of the Covenant, all of those things are involved. All of them. But tell me, where in the book of Revelation is there any mention of the Jubilees? Jubilees. Where? They passed with the passing of Israel as a nation and the times and seasons that pertain to them. Now God is telling us in Revelation the things which must take place. It's necessary. The word is very strong. It is essential that these things take place. You know, it's really remarkable that just with one sweep of understanding and comparison between what Jesus told the disciples when He was with them before He was taken up and what you have in the book of Revelation, you can dispose of endless figuring and adding and subtracting and all kinds of date setting. It's just remarkable how simple the thing can be done, and yet there are individuals who are spending hours and hours of printing and talking all about how they can figure out that in a certain year, 1987 and so forth, is the one certain thing is going to happen. And then the tragedy is how many are applying it and swallowing. Didn't God give us any kind of mind to understand the Scripture? Can't we associate and see how Jesus operated with His disciples before He went left them, and then how the book of Revelation fits into the picture right at the end? Why do we have to go out here meandering down all of these bypaths when the hour of the end is striking at us and they're devoting all of that time and we need to be understanding what's going on in the heavenly sanctuary? 10th verse. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation. When was that assured? When He died on the cross and said, it is finished. Now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ. Therefore, under the circumstances, what can He do? He can establish all of those things. This is it. This is what's going to take place. Okay. Now the book of Revelation itself is divided into some very interesting divisions. Actually, the first 11 chapters constitute one section, and the other 11 chapters constitute a second section. And maybe I ought to just, we'll just briefly run down here and note a few things about the internal evidence as far as these chapters are concerned. You have, in the first chapter, a very key interpretive text. 19th verse. Write the things which thou hast seen, the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. Now, what is John told to do? Write what you've seen, but these things constitute what? The things that are in what day? John's day and onward. And the things which shall be hereafter. then how can I say that the entire book of Revelation is to be fulfilled in the future? No, what is it? Here's the principle again of historical interpretation. Are and shall be. And this is right in the first chapter. Then you have the message to the seven churches, and we need not go into that. And then you come over to the fourth chapter where a door is open in heaven and John is invited to come up and look. And notice the setting. Fifth verse. And out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Now, where were the lamps of fire as far as the apartments were concerned in the typical sanctuary? In the holy place. And it says that the throne of God is there. But I thought the throne of God was always in the most holy place. Can you tell me one reason, or what can you tell me an evidence of why it was not always there, or not it is not always there in salvation history? In the chapter 7 of Daniel, and again you have to go back, when the thrones were cast down and the Ancient of Days did sit, was the Son of Man already there, and he had to be brought? All right. In other words, there was a placing of the thrones of the Ancient of Days. It's that there was a movement on his part, and then there was a movement on the part of the Son of Man. So you see, it's not incongruous to say that the throne of God was in the holy place at this time. All right. Now, interestingly, you have in the Old Testament something more for a further understanding. Where is the throne of God indicated as being? I'm giving this as a suggestion, but yes, but also somewhere else it said something about it in relationship to direction. Sides of the north. Okay, what was on the north of the sanctuary? Table of showbread. Now tell me in the book of Revelation where there's any table of showbread. You have an altar of incense, you have the candlestick, but you have no showbread. What would be in the place of the showbread? The throne of God. And before the throne, go to the north side, look down, and before the throne were what? The seven golden candlesticks. Very interesting. If the table of showbread is constituted as the throne of God, as far as the first apartment is concerned, then we ought to be studying that table of showbread and what it stands for. And what's on the table of showbread? The bread of life. The Word of God. The foundation of the throne is in the Word. Not only that, but connected with that particular table, there was a renewing wind every Sabbath. The Sabbath is involved with the throne. Furthermore, you find in the first chapter of Revelation a very interesting picture. You have Jesus Christ in the midst of the golden candlesticks on the Lord's Day, feeding his people. Picture all fits together, you see, when you bring it in and get it into the picture, the book of Revelation. But you set it in a sanctuary picture. It's setting the Jewish economy, types and antitypes. And that's what makes it even more vital, that in this book that's set in the setting of the Jewish economy and the Jewish sanctuary service, there's not a thing said about the jubilee. That's human manufacturing introducing it in this particular time. God didn't put it in there. God said, this must be. Not that. Okay. When we come here further, we find that in the beginning of the sixth chapter, the seals are open. And that means that we do need to do some studying. And I'm not here to interpret it, except that you have a very interesting picture. You have four horses, right? And then it changes. And you have souls under the altar for the Word of God and for the testimony. That's 6-9. And then you have, when the sixth seal is opened, you have a great earthquake. You have the stars falling, the sun becoming dark, and the moon is blood. And then you have an introduction of a chapter interpolated. before you get to the seventh seal. And that seventh chapter that's interpreted before the seventh seal is the sealing of the 144,000. Again, this is telling you something. If you can mark the time of the sixth seal by the earthquake, the falling of the star, a dark day, then you have some time set for you when you can start looking for the sealing and then the finishing. Now, when was the earthquake? The Lisbon earthquake, 1755, the dark day, May 19, 1780, the stars fell May 1833. Every one of those dates is prior to 1844. Every one of them. Now, if I consider that horse and buggy, and so I'm going to look for the stars to fall and all the rest of the stuff at sometime in the future, how under the sun can I be ready to understand what the nature of the student is all about in this particular thing as far as the picture? Because if you want to notice something, Revelation is expanding. This is expanding from the Old Testament. Go back to Isaiah, the 13th chapter. Notice, beginning with the 9th verse, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be dark in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world," and so forth and so on. Now notice, 12th verse says, "I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger." Between the signs of the heavens and the day of his fierce anger, and his day of wrath, the seven last plagues, he's going to make a man more precious than gold in the golden wedge of Ophir. When is that going to be? Final atonement. And so you have the picture. And so when you get into the book of Revelation, you have the amplification of that picture. And those that have received the final atonement are pictured as 144,000. Then when you come to the 8th chapter, you again have a setting in relationship to the sanctuary. Where are these prayers being offered? The prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. Again, the golden altar which is before the throne. The smoke of the incense went up with the prayers of the saints and so forth, and God responded. Well, now what prayers have been going up? Well, we find it over here in the 6th chapter of the seals. It says there that these individuals that were under the altar, the souls that had been slain, they cried, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given to them, they must rest a little season." All right, when God's people were, you know, ancient Israel were under the heel of the heathen, didn't God intervene? Didn't God send judgment? All right, the trumpets then represent a judgment in time on these that have dealt with God's people. And so you have the trumpets. But then you say, well, where are we going to place the trumpets? Are they parallel with the seven plagues? Hardly. Go to the 11th chapter and let's work back a little bit. 19th verse. "The temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament." All right, now where are we then? We're in the second apartment. The ark of his testament, it says there were thunderings and lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail. When does the great hail come? Seventh plague, the last plague. And so then the temple of God opened in heaven, and the temple seen in the ark of his testament precedes the seventh plague. But then you go up to the 15th verse, it says, "The seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." Christ then has ceased his priestly work and has begun his kingly reign. But when does the seventh angel sound? Go back to the 10th chapter, the 7th verse. "But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared by his servants the prophets." Now what is the mystery of God? Colossians 1:27. What is that? Christ in you, the hope of glory. All right, it says that when the seventh angel sounds, the mystery of God should be finished. Christ in you, the hope of glory. So the probation, 144,000 sealed, man made more precious than gold in the golden wedge of Ophir. You see, when you stand by the fundamental principles of interpretation that have been given to the Advent movement, the whole thing stays in place. And the hope that we have in the final atonement is securely stated. And then you have the 10th chapter. If you're going to put all the trumpets down in parallel into the seven last plagues, what are you going to do about that 10th chapter? What is the 10th chapter all about anyway? It's about a little book that was once closed, is now open in the angel's hand. And the swearing is in the sixth verse that there's going to be time no longer. That has to do with the experience. And John was told to what? Eat the book. It's sweet to the mouth and bitter to the stomach. 1844. Well, now, if that be the case, and we have an experience here that was the experience of God's people, and there was an experience that evidently that they had to prophesy again. They were prophesying, but something went wrong, or something they didn't understand, they had to prophesy again. That's verse 11. To many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Then there's going to be something coming after, isn't there? Well, then, as far as those trumpets that were before the 10th chapter, must be before it in time. So you have a groundwork and a structure in which to start studying the trumpets and the seals. Instead of saying, okay, it's all down here, we're going to have a great heyday of telling you all about what's going to happen. Some of it's already happened. And we need to understand it. But now it says there in that 11th verse, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Now, what's that? Revelation 14. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. Thou must prophesy again. What were they going to prophesy? That group that came out of the disappointment? The three angels missing. The whole picture just drops in so clearly, so plainly. Isn't that what Miller said? That he wanted the thing done in such a way that what? He said, I was satisfied that the Bible is a system of revealed truth so clearly and simply given that the wayfaring man, though a fool, need not err therein. Even the fools ought to understand it. That's saying something too, isn't it? To those that won't understand it. Now, we come to the second section of the big pardon? Left? Okay. Alright, in the here in Revelation, the 12th chapter, you have the setting for all that follows. You have a woman with the dragon. The dragon persecutes the man-child. That man-child is Christ. Then you have the dragon persecuting the woman. And then you have the dragon making war with the remnant of her seed. Now, what does it mean, remnant of her seed? Beg pardon? Well, what do you mean by last part of the seed of the woman? Is that? All right, then if there's a remnant of the seed, there's a first seed, isn't it? Who's the first seed of the woman? The man and child. Now look at that chapter carefully and tell me something. Against who only does the dragon roar? What? Against the man-child and the remnant of her seed. He's wroth with the woman. But he roars only with the man-child and the remnant of her seed. May I put it another way? He roars only with the son, the bridegroom, and the bride. He's angry with the rest. But he especially has his antipathy and creates a war with the other. Because he knows that that bride, the remnant of her seed, are going to stand in a closer position than he ever was, that he tried to block in wanting to be into the creation picture. Now we come then, in this outline, what power does he use to war against the woman? Well, sure, but during the time, times and a half of times, isn't it? But what power actually operates during that time? The first beast of Revelation 13, which is the composite of all. Daniel 7. Then the last part against the remnant, whom does he operate through? The second beast. It's the second beast that's involved there that says, let's make a what? Image. Now remember, the image is not the second beast. It's that which the second beast creates or causes to be created. Now, we come to the third angel's message. And again, let me mention this. Out of this warfare, the 13th chapter, the 14th chapter begins with, again, the picture of the 144,000. You see? You have in the first section, you can lead it up to the 144,000. Now then, in this next section, is again, the struggle ends up in the 144,000. Then you drop back to the three angels' message, and it leads up to the people to keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. In other words, the whole thing moves point by point and focuses on that grand objective that God has. Because after all, does not a groom look forward to the time that he can be with the one he has asked to be his bride? Isn't that the focus of attention? All right, you have that same picture in the book of Revelation. And it finally reaches the culmination of the 19th chapter, which I hope we can get to. But I want to point out to you a little bit about the three angels' messages. All right, it says there, first angel's message, fear God and give glory to Him. The hour of His judgment is coming. Worship Him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of water. And then down to the third one. And we discussed this with some of us that were here last Sabbath. If any man worship the beast in his image, what's the beast? Okay, that's a good general answer. Now give me something that says scriptural. Notice that 18th verse of the preceding chapter. Here is wisdom, let him that has understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a what? If any man worship man. You see, the issue today in the church is not the Sabbath. I said in the church is not the Sabbath. The dissidents in the community of Adventism, the main center in the hierarchy of the Adventism, they all believe the Sabbath, don't they? But what's the issue? Worship of man. The three angels' message says, fear God and give glory to Him and worship Him who made. The man that has, the one that has power to create. That's the basis of righteousness by faith. How can I have righteousness by faith? I can't produce it myself. It must be produced by Him who can create it. Jesus is made unto us righteousness. This is the picture. This is the three angels' messages. And then you go on into the fact of the close, the seven last plagues, and then you have the picture then of a final conflict in the 17th chapter. And I must quickly now enter into this thing so that you can get something to go by. Because over this is where a lot of the speculation is coming today. You have in the 10th verse, there are seven kings. This is talking about the seven heads. There are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. Okay. Now, let's catch the setting of this. Notice the 17th verse. I mean, the first verse of the 17th chapter. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven angels and seven vials, and talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. I will show thee. Who is then this angel talking to? John, and he's talking to him, so John observes it from his point of view. Now, let's go to that 10th verse again. There are seven kings, the seven heads. How many had fallen? Five. All right, the Old Testament tells you. Now, this is from John's day. What was the first power that persecuted the people of God? Egypt. Next, Assyria. Next, Babylon. Next, Medo-Persia and Greece. Five. What is? But Daniel tells you that Rome is what? Both phases. The little horn never left the beast. The other little horn, the two phases that came out is Rome in both phases. The two legs, Rome. One is. And how long did Rome continue? A long period of time. Now next, what does it say? And one is not yet come. That's the second beast of Revelation 13. It hadn't come. And when it cometh, it must continue what? A short time. We are now in the 200th anniversary, right? We've had the 200th anniversary. Compared with that which has gone before, and the failure is a short time. It should tell us how short time is. And so you have the whole picture brought together. And then you have another key part in here, and I'm not going to go into the end chapter. Yes, I'm going to the 19th chapter. The whole thing culminates in this. Nineteenth chapter, sixth verse. And I heard as it were the voice of a great multitude, and as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of mighty thundering, saying, Alleluia, for the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to Him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and His wife hath made herself ready. In other words, it's the Lamb that marries. And it says here, let us be glad and give honor to Him, for the marriage of the Lamb is coming. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, pure and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. And He says unto me, write, blessed are they that are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And He saith unto me, these are the true sayings of God. My brother, my sister, you and I, can be in that picture, either as the wife of the Lamb or those called as the marriage supper of the Lamb. And that is the whole thing to which the book of Revelation projects its point and focus. All the other things move up to that point. And then comes the end, because immediately the next picture is the 10th or 11th verse, and I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called faithful and true, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. He comes forth to get his bride. And then it's eternally with him. What a picture. If we'll just get this overall picture and the overall scenes and the interrelationship and hold to the faith committed to our trust. And develop that truth to a higher plane than it was committed to us. So I hope that out of this brief study of these fundamental principles of interpretation, based upon our roots, the principles that were given in the Eighth Advent Movement under William Miller, we can hold to it